I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. In this issue, I'm joined once again by Boy Wonder Jack Howard as he and I go head to head on the thorny issue of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Jack, this podcast exists purely because of something that you said.
I've requested this.
You
debate.
Did. So tell the I'm going to back away. I'm going to put full response. So this isn't Kermode on Film. This is Howard on Film. Okay. Let's imagine that.
Welcome
I'm
to
the
my
guest.
Takeover.
Welcome to your takeover, Jack. What are we doing and why?
We're going to be discussing Pirates of the Caribbean, and I want to do this because
Clarkson.
Right. Okay. You said you're going to leave it to me. Don't interrupt.
Okay. Sorry.
We're going to be discussing Pirates of the Caribbean.
You've got really bossy as you get older.
You know what?
Yeah.
Granddad.
Yeah.
Calm down.
I will actually. I'm going to let... Okay.
We're going to be talking about Pirates of the Caribbean. And we're going to be doing that because we all know Mark's thoughts on Pirates of the Caribbean. And I mostly agree that it is trash. But I think the first one specifically is a pretty brilliant big high concept fantasy swashbuckling brilliant movie, and I think that you're wrong about the first movie. I think that the first movie is actually one of the better in that genre that's ever been made.
You don't know what this is, do you? Aztec gold. The heathen gods placed upon the gold a terrible curse. 10 years we search. Every last piece we have found. Save for this.
Hello, Bobby. They've taken Elizabeth.
Welcome aboard the Black Pearl.
We must save her.
Where do we start?
Jack Sparrow. He talked about the Black Pearl.
Make a deal with him. He can lead us to it.
You forget your place. You are a blacksmith.
If you spring me from this cell, I shall take you to the Black Pearl and your bonny lass.
You're a pirate.
Forgot one very important thing, mate. I'm Captain Jack Sparrow.
Can we begin by establishing that we're talking about the first film and that the rest of them are irredeemable rubbish?
So I haven't even seen what's known in the UK as Salazar's Revenge.
Which over somewhere else is called Dead Men Tell No Tales.
Dead Men
Tell No Tales,
which I think is just a name of another film, and they do that thing.
I mean, I have seen all of them. Okay, so
I'm so sorry.
I have seen every single one of them, and so I'm quite happy to sort of narrow this down to number one.
Yep.
I think it was the second one that was the point at which I really started losing my temper with the series. By the time we got to whichever the last incarnation was, the fact that they couldn't even decide on a title, it did just look like a bag of bones, bits of leftovers, and all the rest of it. So,
like Johnny Depp is like learning his lines through an earpiece.
I think the word learning is you know, that was the old Marlon Brando trick that
Superman, right?
Well, in loads of things. I mean, apparently the first time Marlon Brando did it was in The Formula with George C. Scott, when George C. Scott was a great actor, would be doing his lines and Marlon Brando would be getting them in his ear. And then David Thewlis tells this story about on the set of The Island of Dr. Moreau, which, of course, started being directed by Richard Stanley. And then Richard Stanley was removed and they got in John Frankenheimer and Val Kilmer was an idiot. And the whole thing was a disaster. But Marlon Brando was having his lines sent to him, through a shortwave radio. and David, and there he is as on the island of Dr. Moreau, and he was, David Thewlis said that he'd be doing a speech about genetic engineering, and it would suddenly be interrupted by police shortwave radio, and he'd suddenly announce that there was a robbery at Woolworths.
Is that true?
Which is what David Thewlis said.
Well, yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to let you start.
Okay, so what I've done is I've prepared five topics.
Okay.
Like five things to talk about for the film.
Okay.
And we're going to discuss them in an order.
Right.
Okay, so we're going to start off with what I assumed when we brought it up on the last podcast would be something that we would universally just agree on. They're like, yeah, okay, that's good, but like not everything else.
Okay.
But Johnny Depp's performance as Jack Sparrow
is
the first topic. Mm-hmm. And I think it's absolutely fantastic. And I thought you would just go, oh, yeah, of course, in the first one it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. But you don't think
I think it's terrible.
Why?
Well, do you want to go first on why it's fantastic, or do you want me to go on why it's terrible?
So, what I know about the performance is that when Johnny Depp was doing research for it, he found out that there was a comparison from pirates to rock stars, which is why he was like, okay, I'll act like a rock star. And I love as well that in the script, they originally wanted Jack Sparrow apparently to be like just some silly, nothing jester type character, and he wasn't even going to be in it that much. And then the producers really wanted him to be like a Han Solo, but in a pirate world. And then Johnny Depp apparently turned up to a table read and just did that. And the producers were really worried, but Gore Verbinski was like, no, I trust it. And I think it works. Mm. And I think it massively paid off, because I saw this when this came out in 2003, I was 11? 12? Yeah. Something like that. So I was like bang in the middle of like target audience for this new movie. And I think growing up, seeing that performance just defined, like, I can't see Johnny Depp in that performance. This, of a similar way to, you know, it's one I bring up all the time, but I can't see Heath Ledger behind the Joker. I can't see Johnny Depp behind that first film. Everything after that, it feels like he's been doing like a version of that, but never really getting the dynamic right. Because I think that what's so great about that performance is that he's combining this weird jester, rock star, like drunk role, but you're not really sure who he sides with. You're not sure if he is an idiot or if he is really smart. You're not sure if he is going to be betraying them or if he's going to be loyal. He's sort of all of it. And the unpredictability of it, I find super interesting. And the performance of it is really funny and quotable. I just think it's a fantastic on-screen performance.
I'm Captain Jack Sparrow. Savvy? Now, as long as you're just hanging there, pay attention. The only rules that really matter are these. What a man can do and what a man can't do. For instance, you can accept that your father was a pirate and a good man, or you can't. The pirate is in your blood, boy, so you'll have to square with that someday. Now, me, for example, I can let you drown. But I can't bring the ship into Tortuga all by me once, savvy? So... can you sail under the command of a pirate? Or can you not?
So, I was a huge fan of Johnny Depp. I loved him as an actor. I thought he was a really physical actor, with the exception of Benny and June, which annoyed me. I remember seeing, you know, things like Gilbert Grape and particularly Ed Wood. I mean, I just thought, and, you know, Edward Scissorhands, I thought he was a really brilliant physical actor. And I interviewed him a couple of times and I compared him to a silent movie star, which I think, you know, was where he was kind of coming from. As far as Pirates is concerned, I know nothing about the background of the script. What I do know is that the part wasn't written like that, and that Johnny Depp came in and did that. And, you know, apparently the producers were worried, but Verbinski went, yeah, you know, this is great. Let's go with it. I think that performance is the least controlled, most ill-disciplined, most self-indulgent thing Johnny Depp has ever done. For me, it's the turning point in his career between him being somebody who was a really sort of physically precise actor to somebody who had turned into a Johnny Depp caricature. And when I see that role, all I can see is Johnny Depp. And I think two things happen. I think the first thing is, firstly, the pirate rock star thing. Okay, there's nothing new in Pirates Are Rock Stars. And I know he says, well, you know, I hung out with Keith Richards, and then Keith Richards turns up in a thing, which is funny.
In the third one, yeah.
Because what he sounds like he's doing is an impression of David Bowie doing an impression of Anthony Newley. Oh. So firstly, okay, nail your rock stars down. Secondly, it's one of those performances that I can just see Gore Verbinski on set going, Johnny Depp's doing this. I can't believe I'm directing Johnny Depp. I'm just going to leave him alone. And the producer.
But I don't think it does feel like that. I think it feels like he's...
His whole thing is just like, I'm doing this. It's all the time. It's like, I can read the set. I can see, oh, wow.
Is that your Jack Sparrow impression?
That is what it's like. Honestly, I had said to my... I went to see the first Pirates with Nigel Floyd. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I went to see the first Pirates with Nigel Floyd, and we went, this is great. We're going to see a pirate movie. Because since Cutthroat Island, nobody done pirate movies. And I actually quite like bits of Cutthroat Island. I mean, bits, not the whole thing. But, and I went in and...
Don't embarrass yourself.
And hey, no, I mean, the point is I'll stand up for things that I quite liked. It's rubbish, but I quite liked it. And then Roger, who was the editor of The Observer, went, this is great, you're going to see a pirate movie. And Nigel and I were going, yeah, pirate movie. And then 30 minutes in, it was like, is he going to do that all the way through?
Oh,
is he literally going to do that? No, that's what I thought. And then I've thought that all the way through every movie. Oh, I'm going to do Jack Sparrow.
I wish, podcast listeners,
I can't quite decide.
I wish you could see the visual that I'm seeing.
The sort of rolling.
It's like Johnny Depp's in the room.
Yeah, well, as I said, my description of it was, it said it's like a drunk karaoke singer showing off in a small room. And that's what I felt.
I don't
like.
Think that that's true, because I think you'd be able to see through the filmmaking that he was out of control.
He is out of control.
If the editing and the scenes didn't make sense, or if he was like doing different things in different takes, so like the over the shoulders were different.
No, he's only doing one thing, Jack.
What's that?
The same thing all the way through. It's like this, you know, it's like, oh, okay, fine. Doesn't matter what the tenor of the scene is. And this gurning, it's the worst performance since Benny and June, in which he was basically doing a silent movie star. And I mean, I feel like I'm watching, you know, a bungle out of Rainbow, or it's so, look at me. The worst thing David Bowie ever did was, after studying with Lindsay Kemp, he did some mime on stage, you know, and it was like, David, you'd really know. Yeah, fine.
Stick to the songs.
That's right, you know. I always remember the thing that Alexei Sayle said is, you know, I wouldn't pay money to see somebody climb up a ladder, walk into a wall, or get blown over by wind. I'm not going to pay money to see somebody pretend to do it. And I kind of just feel it's like he's hit this thing that he's... And it's so out of the film.
Not good! Stop! Not good! What are you doing? You burned all the food, the shade, the rum!
Yes, the rum is gone.
Why is the rum gone?
One, because it is a vile drink that turns even the most respectable men into complete scoundrels. Two, that signal is over 1,000 feet high. The entire Royal Navy is out looking for me. Do you really think that there is even the slightest chance that they won't see it?
But why is the rum gone?
Just wait, Captain Sparrow. You give it 1 hour, maybe two, keep a weather eye open, and you will see white sails on that horizon.
Keira Knightley being, at that point, and I was very rude about her, and I was wrong, but, you know, at that point, she's very wooden. And you've got Orlando Bland, that is most bland, and then in the middle of you've got...
Even that I don't agree with.
Shall we move on to your next point?
No, not the next point yet, but I think that, like, the supporting cast...
Yeah.
I think everybody does a really, really great job. Let's get on to the sort of the next part of it, actually, which was actually like part of the story.
Yes, the story.
The story of the first one.
Okay, remind me what the story is.
So I actually think that in today's standards, Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl is actually surprisingly small scale and personal, because it's not about, like, you know, sea monsters and like krakens and the world ending or whatever. It's actually about a bunch of personal relationships that happen to intertwine. So I really love the introduction of both Elizabeth Swann and of Will Turner, especially Will Turner, because I think the first thing you see him do is he's alone waiting for the governor to come down and meet him, and he just plays with a candlestick and accidentally pulls it off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, if that script or not, if that's Gore Verbinski or whatever it was, is just like, okay, he's immediately, this ridiculously handsome man is immediately on my level. He's relatable. He's a bit awkward. And then through every interaction that you see of Elizabeth and Will, you get tension between them, obviously, but you get every exchange is exposition on what their role is in society, how they feel about each other, the fact that they can't be together. All that stuff comes through their performance, and no one ever, I think it's really elegant. Like, nothing ever gets said in a sort of like on the nose way, but you get what's going on. The fact that he doesn't want to call her Elizabeth, the fact that he calls her Miss Swan, the fact that her father interrupts and says, like, the boy has a sense of propriety. Like, and it just feels like I'm getting this world and I understand the dynamic between these two. And even when he offers him the sword, like, you get the idea that Will made that sword, but he's not going to take credit for it because the black, you know, he gives my compliments to the blacksmith. And you just get all this information in a really natural way. And I really, I've come to really appreciate that.
Do you believe for any minute that they're in love, that there is a...
Yeah, to the point where I can remember, actually, I don't like the second one. I like The World's End, actually, a bit more than Dead Man's Chest.
The World's End, the one that starts with the comical scene of child hanging.
It's all over the place, that film. It goes from children being hung to then pirates having swords thrown from the floorboards in a plan that doesn't make sense. It just becomes this wild mess. But I think that, actually, the more that The World's End goes on, the more it actually becomes a little bit more like the first one. But the thing I remember feeling in the third one was proper, like, heartbreak and proper heartfelt. Like, there's a shot that it's burned in my mind from The World's End of when Will's doing up his boots and he's looking for the other one, and then her leg just comes on and she sticks on a rock and she's wearing the other boot.
Yeah.
And then he takes it off her leg and just kisses her leg. And I just remember just feeling like, oh my God, this is like proper on-screen intimacy, and I proper believe that you two are together.
I mean, I honestly believe that those performances were so wooden that, as I said in that review, that bit in the later film, when they finally are embracing each other, I said, it's like watching a nest of tables. It is literally like watching interlocking bits of Jenga. I do not understand at what level I'm meant to believe that this is anything other than Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley playing dress-up. And incidentally, you know, I think that Keira Knightley is actually a brilliant actor. I think that it was very hard for her to be. I mean, I think I was unfair to her in my reviews of those films, because I think that she was wrestling with very shoddy writing. I don't think that Orlando Bloom is ever going to be the world's greatest thespian.
No, he really isn't.
And,
is he?
Because, you know, he seems to have hit the limits of, you know, the three emotions that he can do, and that's fine. And you look at what's kind of happened to their careers since then, but I really struggled to believe in that. I also felt that at every point in the narrative, everything else is pushed to the side of the screen by Jack Sparrow, who's like the drunk relative that you can't get rid of because he's taken residence on the sofa in the front room and he's not going anywhere.
So let's get to that, actually.
Okay.
So the introduction of Jack Sparrow, I think, is one of the greatest introductions to a character I've ever seen on film.
Are you just playing devil's advocate?
I'm really not.
Okay, fine.
So I'm just going to describe again, like...
Yes, go ahead.
Jack Sparrow is introduced without a word being said, and you completely get what's going on. And I think that's a testament to Gore Verbinski and to Johnny Depp. Because I think that in that introduction, you're introduced to him as this... He's on the top of his of the mast, and he looks, you know, in charge and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then he notices that his ship is sinking, and he tries his best to you know, swashbuckle it all out of the thing in a sort of quite a small comedy routine. And then he notices a bunch of hanging corpses, and they're pirates. Mm-hmm. And he takes off his hat in a show of respect and salutes. And then it cuts to him arriving at the bay atop the mast again with pride as he arrives into the port like it was the plan, and just steps onto the land, and just walks forward as if like nothing ever happened. Like, yeah, I meant to sink that ship, and it just feels like, oh, I get who you are. You are surprising, and you are like improvising all the time, and you are proud, and you want to show a certain appearance that maybe isn't true, and then you got that first exchange where he tricked somebody into taking 3 shillings so that he doesn't get to give him his name, and then steals the rest. And it's just all that action is like there's multiple things going on at once. And I just think that you, in the first 3 minutes that he's on screen, you're like, oh, I get everything about who this person is.
What? Hold up there, you! It's a shilling to tie up your boat at the dock. And I shall need to know your name.
What do you say to 3 shillings? And we forget the name.
Welcome to Port Royal, Mr. Smith.
I'll give you this. I think that what you're describing is, is a well-constructed, setup and all that. So my question, therefore, is this. Why is it that if Gore Verbinski can do that in a sequence, that he can't do it over the length of a film? Because actually, throughout Gore Verbinski's career, the two things have defined his movies. One is an absolutely unforgivable inability to rein things in, to make things, short. He's, given half a chance, he just goes longer and longer and longer. And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, if you understand that you can do that sequence and that you can telegraph all that stuff that you've just described, it's, it's fairly straightforward, but it's
effective.
It's effective storytelling. Why then just allow that character to pinball around for the rest of the movie like something over which you, it looks like the least directed performance I've ever seen Johnny Depp do. And when I think Johnny Depp's best performances are with, when he was working with Tim Burton, if you look at Ed Wood, it's the opposite of everything he's doing with the Pirates. It's tiny gestures. It's tiny movements. It's very small, the scene in Ed Wood when he meets Orson Welles and Orson Welles tells him the story about, I never had any control over anything after Citizen Kane. And there's this whole thing that Ed Wood is sitting there in drag in this bar talking to Orson Welles. And Orson Welles is explaining to the worst filmmaker in the world that this is what's happened to him. And Johnny Depp's version of Ed Wood is brilliant because of what he doesn't do. And Verbinski's version of Johnny Depp is do whatever you want and do more and turn it up to 11. And I still think that all Johnny Depp's best performances are the ones when he dials it down and he reins it in. But I'll give you that, I think I'll give you that opening sequence, but I think in a way that just says, then what the hell is happening for the rest of that movie, and then more expansively for the sequels, which get longer and more uncontrolled and more rambling, and more the sequels fall into line with Johnny Depp's character. They become extensions of Jack Sparrow's.
He's a great supporting role in the first film, and the mistake that they made in the sequels is that they didn't understand, because he was never written that way. All a massive mistake that he did. Well, I don't want to use the word mistake.
No, for sure. They're
I'm
good.
Just giving you ammo fine. There.
Yeah, no. I think it's a valid point.
In the first movie, no one knew he was going to do that. He was written to be a completely different way. And then in the sequels, they were like, oh, shit, that worked.
Yeah, to give you ammunition, it's like Peter Sellers in the first Pink Panther films, in which Clouseau is a secondary character.
Yep.
And then the difference is, I think Clouseau is funny. Yeah. but right. It's the same thing about, that works, so let's bring that central.
Let's
so
make by that the time, the main...
you, yeah, they're meant to make that the thing, because when you see the first Pink Panther, what's surprising is how little of Clouseau is in it. Yes. He is absolutely secondary. Okay, so that's a point to you.
Yeah, okay, but let me just, for Johnny Depp's character, for Jack Sparrow, I think that the thing about the first film that's different from the second, you kind of get it a bit in the second and the third, but the more it goes on, the less clear it becomes, I'll give you that. But in the first film, I feel like no matter what he's doing, when you say he's ping-ponging around, I feel like I totally understand why he's doing it constantly.
Can I be honest? I think I think that what's happened is that you've fallen in love with the character and you just will accept it. I think
I think his motivations are totally clear the entire time.
Okay, I think it's like that thing about you'll forgive your friends for eating with their hands, but you'll criticize your enemies for crossing their knife and fork. I think that a part of you're part of your 11-year-old self has fallen. No, but hey, look, that's not a bad thing, because the thing is, I saw Krakatoa: East of Java when I was 6, right? And I thought it was the most brilliant moving thing I've ever seen. And there's a sequence in it, a musical sequence in it, in which this woman sings this song to this man, right? And I thought it was the most thrillingly exciting and romantic thing I'd ever seen. And I went back years later to watch Krakatoa, East of Java, and it's all over the place and it's rubbish, but I don't care because my six-year-old self fell in love with it.
I actually think that the only flaw, well, not the only flaw, but I think one of the major flaws in this film is that there's a brilliant monologue from somebody we haven't mentioned yet, Geoffrey Rush, who is fantastic in this. There's a brilliant monologue where he talks about how he can't feel anything because of this curse that he's under and he wants to just feel human again.
I'm sorry, I'm just sneezing. Right. And I'm not retching. That's the sound of me sneezing. And I'll give you Geoffrey Rush.
Yes.
Okay, I'll give you Geoffrey Rush. You're winning more points than I expected.
Right, but Geoffrey Rush is doing that brilliant monologue, and one of the major things in it is that he says he feels nothing. And yet there's moments in the entire movie while the pirates are still cursed that they feel pain.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, come on, guys, a little bit of consistency with that, please. Like, it just doesn't make sense and it bothers me.
Okay.
Because, anyway.
Okay.
But the story of the movie...
Yeah.
Is that Elizabeth Turner has taken this bit of gold that happened to belong to Will Turner. It then calls out to the pirates and they come back to get it. And the reason they want to get it is because they're under a curse and they need all the pieces of gold returned to where they got it from. Come on! I'm explaining!
I mean, it's literally like... I've already lost interest.
No, because if you explain anything like that,
no,
it becomes boring.
No, that's not true.
It is.
That's not true.
But the reason why
Martin
I'm telling you
Sheen
that...
goes into the jungle in search of the Heart of Darkness.
That's
not boring.
Yeah, but I know, but I don't
Man
know what that's about.
Goes into space in search of infinity.
Yeah, okay. In this one, you've got... people who seek out adventure.
Humphrey Bogart is in love with a woman he can't have because of the war. And so it's like, so there's a thing, and then this other person's got the thing,
and
then it calls out to the thing, but then they've all got...
I understand, a lot of contrivances and all that stuff, but what I like about
contrivances is a polite word for what that was.
But what it does is it entangles all these main characters in a story that needs all those main characters to be a part of it. And what I like about it a lot as well is that the villains aren't going to I want to go and kill this person, or I've got out to get this person, or I've got some revenge on this person. There's elements of that in the story, but really the main thing that they want is to be human again, which is almost mind-blowing that that has been done in a movie, such a sympathetic role for a villain, that they just want to feel feelings again, which is just really weird when you think about that. That's what their entire motivation is.
Okay.
Especially in the world that we live in now, where villains want to take over most movie villains want to take over the world.
Have you seen Child's Play?
The new one?
Any of them?
No, I haven't.
Okay. You've never seen any Child's Play movie?
No, I haven't.
Okay. There's a serial killer. And he's
a baby. A little baby...
A serial killer. A grown-up serial killer.
Oh, right.
And his spirit transfers into the body of a plastic Chucky doll. Right. And all he wants is to be human again.
Right.
That's literally the plot of Child's Play.
Right, great.
And it's fine.
Yeah.
How many characters did that involve? It involves a kid and a toy, right? And the voice of Brad Dourif. And... or AI, he wants to be human for the first time. Or Pinocchio, he wants to be...
Wanting to be human is great, but usually it's reserved for heroes. Pinocchio wanting to be human and things like that.
No, there's plenty of movies in which evil spirits want to take on human form.
And
what's interesting is, I do think that's the most interesting thing about Pirates of the Caribbean, and yet it's not the thing that I would think of the film being about. When I asked you to tell me what the story of the film was, you went off into some...
Oh, right, okay.
London street map version of, And then you go down there, but they've shut that road off. So then you go up part, you have to go with banks busy at this time of day.
Some of the plotting of it, because it is a huge swashbuckling adventure, you can't expect it to just be what when you can just sum it up in a sentence. What I love about it is little details like... Elizabeth Swan is told they're coming to kidnap you because you're the governor's daughter. And then when she is kidnapped, she says, "My name is Elizabeth Turner," to try and protect herself. And then that turns out to be we're looking for the son of a Turner. I like that all this stuff is really smartly set up and it doesn't feel like set up and payoff. It's just woven in a really natural way because it is a huge swashbuckling adventure. It's not supposed to be something that you can sum up in an elevator pitch.
Do you think that the scope of that swashbuckling has anything on Star Wars, for example?
I think it's a completely different thing, but you're talking to somebody who didn't grow up loving Star Wars. Same as you, actually, when we watched The Force Awakens together, actually, we both had the same reaction, which was, I get it now, fun. That's what people love, and now I'm into it, and I've since watched the originals again and had more of an appreciation for them. But I think that probably Pirates of the Caribbean and movies ever since Star Wars owe a lot to Star Wars because of the scope of it all. But I personally prefer Curse of the Black Pearl to any of the original Star Wars movies.
And there was the moment when Jack Howard's career with the young people...
Everyone just like, never listening to anything he ever says again.
So just to absolutely clarify this, Jack, I feel like you're on the Today programme.
Hang on.
Just to clarify this, so you think that Curse of the Black Pearl is better than... Now, I just want to... just some time ago, I wrote a thing in The Observer in which I said, and I did stand by this at the time, that I preferred the Twilight movies to the original Star Wars movies. Okay?
Wow.
No, it's fine. Okay. And it was...
You lose.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And New Moon is one of the worst films I've ever seen.
Oh, New Moon is all over the place. But New Moon is all over the place because there's a sequence in which she literally sulks in a chair for a year.
Yeah. I mean, sulks in a chair for a year. And it's quite an elegant sequence where the weather changes, but that's not enough.
I know.
They bring up on screen... December.
I know. It'd be like if that sequence in Notting Hill when he walks through all the seasons, but they put the dates up. Snowing.
Calendars winter, going by. Yeah.
He's still sad.
Like you put up a crying emoji.
Yeah. So I just want to warn you
the backlash is coming.
I've been there before.
Right.
And it's been nice knowing you.
Yeah. We've both said things like that, so we're on the same team.
Exactly.
This dock is off limits to civilians.
I'm terribly sorry, I didn't know. If I see one, I shall inform you immediately.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You best start believing in ghost stories, Miss Turner. You're in one. Chance you all remember Captain Jack Sparrow. Kill him.
I'm gonna teach you the meaning of pain.
You like pain? Try wearing a corset.
Here they come.
Pirates of the Caribbean, the Curse of the Black Pearl.
I may have deserved that.
So, how have we done? Is that four of them?
We've done Johnny Depp's performance. We've done the story, kind of.
Yeah.
We've kind of covered Gore Verbinski's direction a little bit, but my main point about Gore Verbinski's direction is that I think it's really like efficient and elegant, and like I think now as well, because I'm very unimpressed a lot of the time with big budget filmmaking.
Yeah.
So when something like Mission Impossible Fallout happens.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, they're it's really brilliant. Doing stuff.
Yeah.
And I think
I felt the same way. Felt exactly the same way.
And Gore Verbinski, like, same thing. Like, there's not really any CGI stuff other than the CGI skeletons. There's everything. Like, the ships are real. The battle.
CGI what?
CGI skeletons. What did I say?
I'm pretty sure you said skeletons.
Yeah, sometimes I do that. And I've said it. It's recorded now. Play it again. Just play it in slow motion.
Skeletons.
Wah, wah, wah. Yeah. There's not much CGI in it. The boats are real. The battle with the boats are real. When someone's swinging around, that's all real. And that sort of leads me on to the next thing that I want to talk about, which is the action sequences.
Okay.
And again, I think that Gore Verbinski is the person I'm sort of praising the most is that the action scene, my favourite action sequence in the whole thing is the first sword fight between Jack Sparrow and Will Turner when he meets him in the blacksmiths.
Yeah.
Because it's all just storytelling. The entire time you're just being like taught something about each character. And it's about Will hating pirates and rejecting that idea whilst Jack is manipulating and you're showing a darker side to him, and also how he'll learn to cheat. He'll cheat to win. And all this stuff, you're being taught all that stuff whilst it's this really brilliant and really fun to watch action sequence. And again, real stuff is happening, like the practical side of it. You can tell that they're really doing it.
Okay, again, I would say that the issue is, if you can direct a sequence like that, why can't you direct the whole? Why can't you bring that same thing? And funnily enough, this is a strange comparison, but I think a similar criticism can be leveled at Quentin Tarantino, which is that if you look at The Hateful Eight, how come you can direct a sequence, or Inglourious Bastards? How come you can direct a sequence that is that tight and that, you know, taut and efficient, and yet when you stand back and look at the whole thing, it's like, and I still come back to, we'll talk about this in a different podcast, but the things that you're crediting Gore Verbinski with, I think actually you're making a good argument for them, and I do buy some of them. I do buy that storytelling, you know, through action at the fight. And so in a way,
it's not wasteful. That's what I like about it.
But what's wasteful is the construction of the whole thing. Now maybe that comes down to writing, or maybe it comes down to the fact that in the end what you've got is a picture that's inspired by a fairground ride, which is not a narrative, you know.
It's a stretch, isn't it?
It is a stretch. And consequently, it just feels like a bit, like a whole lot of bits bolted together that individually might work. Now, what's interesting is that I think you're getting something out of it that I never got out of it, which is that you're getting emotional involvement.
Mm.
And you know, like you said, that you are convinced by the love affair. You're convinced by the underlying theme of the pirates want to be human. And that was the stuff. For me, I never connected with any of that stuff. And that's not because I don't connect with pirate movies, because it said if I could enjoy bits of Cutthroat Island, which is a terrible film. But I think there is a thing here, which is if you don't connect, and I think this is the key part. Very early on, I lost it.
Yeah.
And then I wasn't going to be allowed back in again. And I think you would agree that by the time you get to the sequels, they are worse. They are, you know.
Even the first time I watched Dead Man's Chest, it finished on a note that I was excited by, like him coming down, Jeffrey Rush coming down the stairs again, eating an apple. And it just finishing on that cliffhanger.
Yeah.
To me was like, oh my God. Like it was an introduction to filmmaking like that, where they were filming sequels back to back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that I'd never really seen that before. But
well, Back to the Future 2 and 3 back to back on the air, so yeah.
Yeah, but I'd never, you know, I wasn't alive when they came out.
Oh no, of course, because you're a child, sorry.
So I'd never really seen that done before. But
so I asked you if you ever saw Queen play live, and you went,
"Yeah,
you
went, I was born in 1992, Mark."
So sorry,
he was dead.
But I do forget. I mean, you should take it as a compliment that I forget. Yeah. I forget because you know stuff, you know, and then I forget that you're actually just a little baby.
It always comes back to this.
Well, no. I mean, I think you clearly have made an emotional involvement with it, which has enabled you to see things that I didn't see. And yeah. I do buy what you're saying about individual sequences.
I think you're right as well. That I'm arguing it from how I've grown up now, which is to be, you know, I'm a filmmaker who sees the process in the filmmaking. And I really appreciate how well everything sort of like threads through, and everything that is mentioned is never wasted. And, you know, even just like Jack getting deserted on, you see that island later, and then the truth is revealed as to what really happened when they're actually on that island, rather than someone just saying it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it was all a lie, he made it up. Or, you know, that confession never happens. It never needs to, because you see it visually. Everything gets paid off and it all crescendos with all these different characters, and you're right, all these different stories that happen to be ping-ponging against each other. It crescendos in the final battle in the cave, when you've got everybody doing their own thing, and then one of the moments of tension I remember, like, learning about tension, when Barbossa has got a gun pointed to Elizabeth, Jack's got a gun pointed to Geoffrey Rush, and Will's got a sword, and he's got the coins, and everything just freezes, and then you hear a gunshot, and Elizabeth reacts, Geoffrey Rush reacts, and then all of a sudden you find out that Jack has shot him.
"10 years you carry that pistol, now you waste your shot."
"He didn't waste it."
That stuff, I just remember learning about that and being, you know, and seeing that for the first time and being completely convinced that it was going to go wrong. Okay. And you're right, it's the core of every, you know, we're basically just going to the core of every film, that I was emotionally invested from the start, and I was interested, and I have been since, and now I've been able to look at it practically and go, the way you're putting that story together is actually pretty brilliant. To have something that huge and to make it feel so small and intimate is, you know, it's something I appreciated about the new Spider-Man Far From Home as well. Like, it's huge, but it never forgets about the small intimate moments, and I really appreciate that stuff. But when you watched it, obviously, you just didn't get any of that.
And I went in, I promise you this, I went in wanting to enjoy it.
When was the last time you watched it?
I've watched the first one again, some of it last year, because it was on television. And
you were like, nope, still rubbish.
And I just, it's the Johnny Depp performance just absolutely left me cold. But also, by that point, because bear in mind, I watched every single one of them as they came out and then had to review them. As the series went on and got worse, I think that they sort of, I now look back at Pirates through the prism of the worse ones. Mm-hmm. And I think all the arguments that you're making about the construction of Pirate of the first one are valid. I still think that the overall arc is messy, and I think that all the problems
is messy, because the moral at the end of it is that Will learns that sometimes using the methods of a pirate isn't a bad thing. But what that means, to lie and to cheat and to steal and all right, okay, that's where we're being left. All right, just don't think about that too much. But, like, you're right, it's a bit of a mess at the end.
So can we find a sort of an agreement here, which is that we're agreed that the sequels are increasingly rubbish.
Increasingly rubbish, yes.
But I will agree with you that there are things in the construction of that film that, had I not emotionally checked out so early on, I would appreciate, because the way you're describing them, there are individual sequences that are constructed with, you know, with wit and grace.
Efficiency is the word I would use.
Okay, fine. And will you agree that efficiency is not the word that actually defines the whole arc of that movie?
It's long.
It's not just that it's long, Jack. It's that it's what? Which meeting did you arrange? What did you do? Did you get into the editing room and just throw everything up in the air, and then the order that it landed on in the floor, that was how you, which is incidentally how Tony K wanted to edit American History X, as if when they were approaching the very last cut of it, and he'd been having these meetings in which he turned up with a rabbi, a priest, and a monk in order to make the spiritual aura better. He walked into Jerry Greenberg's room, according to Jerry Greenberg, and said, "Let's just throw the whole thing up in the air and see where it lands." And everyone was going, Tony, no.
It didn't work on Pirates of the Caribbean. That's right.
It didn't work on Pirates of the Caribbean.
We're not doing it now. Okay. My final thing, so we've talked about Johnny Depp's performance, Gore Verbinski's direction, the action sequences a little bit, like, you know, not everything can be covered as in detail as we can in the short time we have.
Yeah.
The story, of which you don't think there is one.
No, I think, I think, but if there is a story, it's under so many layers of, you know, it's under so many layers of rewrites that I can't see it anymore.
And the final thing is probably something I hope we can agree on.
Okay.
Is the music.
Oh, yeah.
In the first one, it's by Klaus Badelt?
I'll go with your pronunciations.
And then the sequels, it's by Hans Zimmer.
Yeah.
And I've got to think, there's no confirmation of this anyway, so this is purely speculation. Okay. But, you know, Hans Zimmer's known for having employees coming out of his ears that he just hands off things to and does additional writing for. So Lorne Balfe, who did the new Mission Impossible film, he's been writing with Hans Zimmer for years. Rupert Gregson-Williams, Harry Gregson-Williams, they're all part of Hans Zimmer's little crew.
Right.
And I think Klaus was given this project because Hans was like, oh, Disney are doing some sort of pirates movie. Yeah, you do that. Here's a theme that I've written that I've ripped off from my own score from Gladiator. Sort of take that and then write a score around it. And it's a brilliant score. And then the movie became a super mega hit. And he went, what? Oh, no, I'll do the rest. Give it back. I want my name on it now. And that's how it feels to me. That, like, I'm like, Hans Zimmer didn't do the music for the first one, but people think he did.
Okay. I'd just like to say, for the lawyers, that's Jack Howard. No, I mean, the thing with any musical score and a film is that, as we all know, how musical scores end up being what they are is never a simple, you know, it's never somebody sat down and watched the film and thought, oh, I know what will sound good with that.
Yeah.
And in fact, I was just doing a thing recently, you know, scores that have been written for movies and then dumped, and then but then little bits of them turn up. Mm. And I was looking at the North score for 2001.
Yes, I've been looking at that recently as well.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because it would have been a very, very
changes
different,
the movie,
completely. I mean, particularly like the space docking thing.
Yes,
because you now cannot watch it, but of course you know what happened was temp music,
and it still happens now, which is why music. All sounds, you know, modern wise, that sounds like Hans Zimmer.
Yeah, exactly.
Because everyone goes, let's put the Inception track in for this sequence, and then everyone.
And
goes,
you know what? Do you know what the expression to describe Hans Zimmer's biggest scores is? It's going the full Brahms,
right? Yeah.
And apparently that is Brahms. But it's, you know, the Brahms thing. That is what that's the Zimmer thing. And I was talking to a composer recently who'd composed for a kind of a big British feature, and I said, what does that keep reminding me of? And he went, well, and I went, no, come on, what? Like, what? It's like it's about to turn into something. Well, it turned out it was Zadok the Priest,
right?
And he talked about having a little bit of the Zadok the Priest DNA in his piece, but sometimes you can hear that somebody went, here's a thing,
yep,
you know, work off of that. You know?
There's a really brilliant video actually by somebody who doesn't make video essays anymore, called Every Frame a Painting. Who talked about the music in Marvel,
right,
and modern action movies and how they all rip off from each other, and basically everyone's using temp scores from other films, and that's why everything sounds the same.
Okay.
And I think that that's a really interesting thing to watch if you're interested in stuff like that. But I think that this movie, the entire trilogy, I think has really brilliant music, and I can remember the themes, and they feel like they're attached to certain moments and certain characters. And I think that it does something that I see a lot of other modern blockbusters do, which is overusing the theme.
Right.
So in the first movie,
when every time some character comes on, you get a different,
you don't get that theme a lot. It doesn't give it to you all the time. In fact, I think in the modern, in the later 2 and 3, it doesn't really give you it until the end credits. And it feels really satisfying. It's like, I remember seeing...
It's like, we've got to the end, thank God. Have a bit of music you like. Here we are. Well done.
To walk out.
What day is it? Wednesday.
Still.
You know, yeah.
But, like, I remember seeing Jurassic World, the first reboot, remake, sequel thing.
Yeah.
And Michael Giacchino did the music for that, and I really like Michael Giacchino. And I just didn't like the way that they use the Jurassic Park theme. Like, they get to the Jurassic World and they get to the hotel room and he flings open the windows and the camera soars out onto what looks like Disneyland.
Yeah.
And it just goes, and I was like, I'm looking at a fairground. What? This isn't, that's not dinosaurs. So like it just, you know, it's not deserving of the theme. And I think that what they have is a good reservation of when to give you that stuff. And they have a lot of different themes strung throughout it. And I think it sort of invented the way that pirates sound. It reinvented the way that pirates sound. So I've overwhelmingly positive about that throughout the trilogy, because I think in the new ones it's giving it the Pirates of the Caribbean theme at every possible moment.
Well, look, I think you've done a better job of convincing me of the merits of it than I expected.
I take that as a win.
No, I think I will give you that.
I thought you'd just like disarm everything I said.
No, because I'm more reasonable than perhaps.
I'm a fair god.
I'm a prankster god. I want to finish on this. You mentioned Michael Giacchino. One of the things I like most about Michael Giacchino is that Michael Giacchino's Twitter handle is Giacchino.
No. Yeah. Not Giacchino.
Exactly. As Kermode, I just kind of think, yeah, exactly. You know what's important. Giacchino. Jack, okay, yeah, I'll give you that one.
Are you sure?
I think I will, yeah.
Well, I think I'm a little bit more passionate.
You are, and I think it does demonstrate that passion will always out, you know. And I think probably it's, you know, because we're agreed that everything got so much worse in the sequels, I am willing to give you, because I didn't hate Pirates of the Caribbean. I hate the sequels.
Yeah, I think that like when you get to Naomi Harris, turning into a big crab lady, I check out. I'm like, this is ridiculous. Like, I remember actually seeing it for the first time and feeling hatred. And being like, what is this? Like, what is going on? And, just all the multiple Jacks. Like,
oh, yeah, the multiple Jacks. It was just like, one was bad, and now I have
15. Now they're 15, talking to each other.
And they're in, he's dead, or he's not dead. It's like, what? It's, you know, it's like a pop video that somebody wanted to put at the beginning of the film, but, you know.
It's just bizarre, and
listen,
it gets worse.
Quit while you're ahead, okay? Yeah. I'll give you that one.
Mr. Sparrow, I can. What say you about the condition of this tack line?
It'd be proper to my eyes, sir.
Proper? It is neither proper nor suitable, sir. It is not acceptable nor adequate. It is an obvious fact, an abomination.
Begging your pardon, sir, but perhaps if you gave a man another chance,
shall I?
That sort of thinking got us into this mess.
Well, thanks for listening to this Kermode on Film podcast. If you've enjoyed it, tell your friends and remember to subscribe.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.